I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Patrick LeBrun. Patrick, welcome back.
Yes, great to be here.
So last Saturday, we were at the New York Forum. You spoke, I spoke. And after the forum, Mike Enoch placed on his hand this sacred magical oven mitt. And we all felt it. We all felt this strange wave of energy coursing out through the world. And then not long after that, we all got news that some guy, some kebab from Afghanistan, had planted a bomb. We didn't know it was a kebab. We knew it was a kebab. Of course, the world didn't know until the next morning. But a bomb went off, and we had been talking about what do you think would really seal the deal for Donald Trump. And the consensus was, of course, more Muslim terrorism and more Black Lives Matter rioting. And we've seen that delivered in spades. And of course, I don't want to blame Mike for this. I don't really think that the holy oven mitt caused this. But still, it was a remarkable coincidence. And it just shows, though, that, you know, we know what's happening. We know the forces at work. We know it's going to put Trump in the White House. So anyway, I wanted to have you come on and talk a bit about the recent bombing in New York. And also, you know, the background of this in policies connected with refugees, visas, and so forth. And we can also talk a bit about what's happening in the Black Lives Matter world as well. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much. And, you know, usually I'm saying very critical things about the U.S. government. I'll start by just pointing out one thing that they got right, and that was the Najibullah Zazi plot, which was in 2009, it was essentially a reproduction of the London subway attacks that would have hit New York. And, you know, it's really clear that this was a for real plot, because it wasn't the case where you have, you know, like in Florida, there's that time they had like four or five black teenagers. Some of them were literally retarded, and they were provided with PlayStation and bottomless weed. And their handler would come by every couple of days, like, "Hey, you guys down for the jihad?" "Yeah, yeah, we're down for the jihad." "All right, where's the weed? You know, pass the doobie." You know? And these guys were, you know, eventually, you know, entrapped and brought to court, and the FBI can go to Congress and tell them we did a great job, up the budget next. In the Najibullah Zazi case, it was a guy who lived in New York for a while. He was his family was from Afghanistan originally. He was born in Afghanistan as well. And he moved to Denver. He was being watched. He was a person of interest. And then suddenly he disappears. And the FBI totally freaked out. And what happened was he was driving nonstop from Denver to New York City, which is a pretty long drive to go nonstop. They had some very sophisticated chemical concoctions that they were putting together. And they had a well-constituted team of people who were going to place these bombs. And in the chaos of trying to arrest him and his team, they went to one of their informants, who was an imam, a community leader, and they told him, "All right, you know, we need to find this guy." And he double-crossed the FBI. He went and told the family and a whole bunch of other people, "Okay, let this guy know that the FBI is looking for him." And there was also, you know, some difficulty in coordination between the police and the FBI. With, you know, I think at the end of the day, though, on that front, you know, if a pitcher wins a game in a baseball game, you know, they don't not often will you hear people say, like, "Well, you know, you did walk a guy, and there are a few people on base." You know, at the end of the day, they won, they stopped it. But what's really interesting about that and some of the more recent cases is this issue of how they got here and how can we predict who is dangerous. I mean, in his case, he was on the watch list, and actually the way that they got him to talk, so I haven't seen anything that's very clear about how he came to the U.S., but the way that they got him to eventually talk was that they threatened to charge the rest of his family with perjury. His parents put them in jail. And say that they had lied on their application, which leads me to believe that they actually claimed refugee status. They went from Afghanistan to Pakistan in 1992 and from Pakistan to the U.S. in 1999. But if that's not the case with him, it's certainly the case with one of his co-conspirators, Adis Medunjanin, who is a Bosnian who came over in 1994. He's now serving a life sentence in federal prison. So if he came over from Bosnia in 1994, I think we can assume he was a refugee. He didn't win the lottery. But yeah, why am I focusing on this question of who's a refugee and who's not is that Hillary Clinton had a press conference recently since the attack, and she was asked about, you know, if I don't know if it's to phrase it specifically about if Trump was right or not, but she was saying that essentially there needs to be a stricter visa process. She mentioned specifically the 9/11 terrorists and said that they were not refugees, and that because of that, we need to change the way visas are granted. But, well, there's one problem with that, isn't there? That's that she was the Secretary of State from 2009 to 2013. And so she had ample time to change this way things are done. But yeah, if we look over the other more recent attacks, I mean, the Tsarnaev brothers, they were refugees from Chechnya. There's no doubt about that. He was also on the terrorist watch list, for the FBI. The son and the mother were, and the mother was on the CIA watch list for a while. The younger son, who was a kind of a pothead, he was not ever on their watch list, but he definitely carried out the attack along with his brother. And then we have the homegrown guys like San Bernardino, Omar Mateen, who was the Orlando shooter, and then Ahmad Rahami. It seems that he came over probably in a lottery because his father tried to come over as a refugee several years before they made their move to the United States.
Well, there's some interesting lessons here. The first lesson, of course, is that Trump's proposal to stop immigration from Muslim countries, of course, is an obvious no-brainer if we want to get a handle on Muslim terrorism. The second thing is that, yes, there is a connection between terrorists and refugees. Terrorists come in as refugees, and there are concrete examples of that. The third thing that I think is really even better for our narrative, frankly, is that a lot of these people were not predictable terrorists. They seem to be ordinary, assimilated, blokey Muslims who were not threatening, not particularly religious, the kind of guy that you could hang out with and trade banter with and things like that. And yet they turn out to be jihadis. That means that any Muslim can go jihadi. And you talked about that in your last one, where a lot of people who are quote unquote bad Muslims, they like to smoke and drink and whore around and stuff like that. They grab onto jihad as the one virtuous thing, the one commandment of Islam that they can actually carry out. And they try and redeem their sorry lives with becoming a terrorist, basically.
Yeah, that's certainly the case with the older Tsarnaev brother. I mean, he's kind of a douchebag amateur boxer. And, you know, he defended Islam just as a identity thing, really, more than as a practitioner. And then Omar Mateen was regular at the Pulse nightclub. I mean, there are numerous people who said that they recognized him and knew his name. And of course, there were all the people who saw him on Grindr. I think that there was, and also his first wife. You know, when she was asked if he was gay, you know, she obviously was taken aback by it. And it's really like a lesson in nonverbal communication, because you know her eyes immediately go down and to the left, and then she scans across the room and she takes a big gulp, and then she says, "I don't know." you don't have to be a genius to know what's going on inside her head, you know, when that discussion is. So yeah, right. I mean, these people are not, they're not all bearded guys wearing, you know, thin cotton dresses, you know, with little skull caps on. It's all kinds who pull it off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the other thing that Hillary and Obama have tried to promote is the idea that they can stop them with gun control, that somehow this list is that they can prevent people who are on the list from purchasing weapons. And there are two problems with that. One is that, you know, a lot of these people weren't on the list. You know, the guy who just recently did these bombings, his father actually reported him to the authorities. And after a couple months of investigation, and of course there's no transparency for the father to know what kind of investigation they're having, but after a couple of months, they determined that the father was just pissed off at the son for being kind of a ne'er-do-well, and that he was trying to hurt him by saying that the kid was a terrorist. And so they dropped him off of their investigation radar. But even for those who, and also the San Bernardino killers were not on the radar of the feds, but even if they were, and even if there was such a ban in place, you know, they had one of their buddies, a guy named Enrique Marquez, who was a convert to Islam, buy the weapons for them. You know, so there's really no foolproof way around. There's no, you know, no cultural Marxist or kind of 1970s style liberal solution to this problem. There's only the remove kebab solution, frankly.
Right. Another lesson in passing to mention from what you were saying is that it's not just Muslims from the Far East. We've also had Albanian Muslims.
Right.
And Bosnian Muslims who have been involved in terrorism, in jihad. You know, it's not so simple as a difference between Europeans and non-Europeans. Islam cuts across Europe.
Correct.
There are European Muslims, and we still should be concerned about them.
That's right, yeah. Actually, you know, I mentioned first the guy who's serving a life sentence in the Najib al-Azazi New York subway plot. But also there was an attempt to carry out a plot against Fort Dix in New Jersey. And that was basically an Albanian family that was going to do this. And they had actually crossed into the United States illegally from Mexico. And that was before the, you know, the Iron Curtain had fallen. It was still, you know, the Cold War. And they were granted amnesty. I guess they were on the tail end of the Reagan amnesty. And so they were one of these famous, I think they call them, what do they call them? OTMs, I think is what they call them, other than Mexican. And that's something that the Border Patrol keeps track of. And, and the disturbing thing is so many of these OTMs that cross the border, actually used to be in the hundreds, maybe now it's more in the thousands, are from Syria, Iraq, and other countries of interest. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We can't just say this is a question, this is an Arab problem or an Arab and Pakistani problem. Because we have these Albanians and Bosnians who are also turning to violent jihad against the West, essentially.
Yeah, that's interesting. And boy, that amnesty sure worked out well for us. And and also, I guess Trump is right. The southern border is a route that terrorists can use to get in, and maybe we should close that off as part of our anti-terrorist policies.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, it's just that it's the same as people say all the time that, you know, the prisoner thinks more of how to break out of prison than the guard, right? So the prison will eventually figure it out. I mean, the same is true for the terrorists. You know, they are constantly probing for weaknesses in the system. It may not be the guys who are carrying out the attacks who are doing that probing, but the strategists are always figuring out what are the weaknesses in the system to be exploited and how to get one over on us. So the southern border is obviously something that's been on their radar for decades now.
And for obvious reasons, it's a very, very soft, porous barrier.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I heard a story years ago that, you know, if you went to places like Indiana, that if you went to a sushi restaurant, they'd actually have Mexicans making the sushi, like a light-skinned Mexican, I guess, because people couldn't tell the difference between a Japanese guy and a Mexican guy.
That's hilarious.
I don't know if that's true or not, but frankly, you know, how many people can tell the difference, you know, if they live in Arizona or New Mexico, how many can tell the difference between, you know, a guy from Pakistan and a guy from Honduras, or a guy from, you know, Saudi Arabia and a guy from Guatemala, you know?
Yeah. Years ago when I was in Atlanta, I went to a kind of teriyaki fast food restaurant, and the white guy at the counter took my order, and he said over the microphone to the people in the kitchen in the back, "Numero seis, grande." And it's like,
yeah.
Every restaurant's a Mexican restaurant today when you go in the kitchen and actually
it's
see
true.
Who's cooking.
Yeah, it's true. But yeah, I mean, the other thing is that There's the marriage thing, you know, Tashfeen Malik, who carried out the San Bernardino attacks along with an American-born Muslim, Saeed Farooq. She was born in Pakistan. She was educated at the Lal Masjid, which was a center of radicalism that was so serious that the government raided it and then it destroyed the entire building, sending people scattering into the highlands to hide out. She was educated there. They got married while she was seeking higher education in Saudi Arabia, and then she came to the U.S. And with that visa, that kind of visa, there's really nothing that can be done to stop it. You know, it's not like there's, you know, it's not like with refugees, like, okay, let's do some kind of research in the background, or with even like the lottery systems, I think there's some kind of due diligence. But when families are getting together, especially married couples, I'm not sure that there is a lot that they can do to impose choice from the state. And so,
oh yes, they can. Of course, they can. They can say,
oh, not that they're doing now, yeah.
Not
yeah.
that they're doing now, but you know, we believe in keeping families together. Right. And if this guy's marrying a woman who's not acceptable, he has to know that she cannot become a U.S. citizen or a U.S.
Yeah.
resident. It's like, okay, we're all for your family staying together, but it's not going to be within our borders.
Yeah.
In fact, that would be a very useful technique of getting rid of some of these
people.
Oh,
yeah.
It's like, okay, you're fallen in love with somebody. Well, she can't come here.
Yeah, then we'll see if it's true or not. Yeah, I mean, the investigators are not empowered to look into these other issues. All that they look into is whether or not their marriage is legit, and that's it. That's the only thing that they're concerned about.
Right.
You know, there's another kind of visa as well that is really horrible. It's you know, basically anyone who makes an investment in the U.S., and I've heard differing amounts of either $500,000 or $250,000. That they get a visa, and that not only does the investor get a visa, but also the spouse can apply, and also the children can be applied for. And they're essentially buying a green card to the U.S., and it's an amazingly cheap access, you know, when you think about it. If you know, there are lots of very wealthy Chinese who are buying passports from other countries, and I think that the cheapest one out there is from Dominica, a Caribbean country, not to be confused with the Dominican Republic, and you can buy a passport from there for $100,000. And there are a few other countries who are known for selling their passports, and yeah, and it's really pretty sad and disgusting that the United States is not selling passports, but selling green cards for as little as $250,000. That's really really incredible.
And let's face it, somebody with Osama bin Laden's amount of money could buy a lot of green cards for a lot of terrorists.
Yep, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. Yeah, I'm not aware of a case where they actually use that, but that's absolutely right. They definitely could. And maybe it's happening, we just don't know, because we don't have full transparency on how people got here.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe it just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, it's only a matter of time. Yeah, there's a lot that needs to be done. And of course, you know, I believe it's the most who come to the United States to receive green cards. They have won a lottery, which is got to be the dumbest plan in the world for bringing in new people. Just to be lucky, you know. If you compare it to, say, a country like Australia, where at least they have a point system and they actually put some thought into who will contribute to the country. Of course, I think the program that we would love the best would be one that would also preserve the genetic inheritance and the culture of the country in place already. But at the very least, you know, not a lottery.
Yeah, definitely. Most definitely.
Yeah. But, so Clinton, I think that this is one of those things what she really put her foot in her mouth on, because and I think this is something we might see brought up in the debates that are coming up very soon. She was at State Department as the Secretary of State for 4 years. 9/11 happened 8 years before that, and here she is saying that, you know, the lessons of 9/11 are that we should change our visa program. And she didn't do a thing at all. And of all these emails of hers floating around out there in the public space, you know, I challenge anybody listening to find her mentioning a need to reform the visa program in those emails. because this is simply she's a Johnny come lately to an issue that Trump has pioneered, like so many.
Exactly. It's her way of me-tooing Trump without agreeing with Trump, basically. So, Patrick, there are a lot of aspects of this New York bombing case. 11 bombs in 24 hours planted by this guy who was from Afghanistan. Could have been any Muslim, right, though. By all accounts, he was just a regular bloke. Only one of 11 bombs went off. I guess we can be glad that the guy was apparently not smart, but there were several other factors that foiled his bombing campaign. So, well, let's talk a bit about that, because there is some humor to this horrible thing.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, it's a very New York kind of thing that, you know, you can't leave anything sitting out for 10 minutes, even a bomb. And that was clear with this guy. He leaves out a rolling piece of luggage on the side of the street. And, you know, not very long after he leaves it there, two guys were walking down the street. They open it up. They pull it a little ways. They open it up to check out what's inside. And then they see the bomb. They pull it out and they sit on the sidewalk. And then they steal the piece of luggage to keep for themselves. And they're currently being sought by the authorities. They also looked like they could be, you know, Pakistani guys. And at first, you know, at the first announcement I heard about it, they were really cautious to say, like, you know, we saw this happen and we don't know if they're part of the team or not. We don't want anyone to assume that they are, even before they released the video of it. But yeah, they're still searching them out. And then in the case in New Jersey. So the pipe bombs were – the way that they were set off or were supposed to be set off was that he would call them, and by calling them, that would initiate the explosion. And so he placed them, you know, at the – probably that one that was placed in Chelsea, you know, with a certain time in mind as to when he would blow it up. And, of course, the ones for the next morning for the commute out of Elizabeth, New Jersey. And so he planted these at the train station. A bum comes by, and it was four pipe bombs in the backpack. He steals the backpack. He hears metal clinking around inside, opens it up, and the lucky guy, you know, wasn't blown up by these things. And then he ran to the nearest cop to tell them, I was trying to steal this bag and found a bunch of bombs inside.
Arrest me, right.
And that was why they were able to close down the station and have the bomb-diffusing robot come to take it out. And that's where they have the picture of one of them accidentally going off as well while the robot's trying to defuse them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so, I mean, you can't even leave bombs lying around in New York very long before they get stolen. You know? But yeah, it's an interesting case. You know, I can't imagine that he worked alone. We know that at least one of his family members had filmed him testing the bombs in his backyard. And also we know that he is not talking yet. Now, here's part of the issue with that. He's a U.S. citizen now. And in fact, DHS released since then that 800 people were accidentally given citizenship while also on the terrorist watch list. I think it's just in this past year. And so that's under John Kerry as Secretary of State, under Barack Obama, and probably using the exact same controls that were in place while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. You know, I can't imagine John Kerry coming in and loosening controls or loosening oversight. And so we have to imagine that the same kinds of mistakes were being made during those 4 years that Hillary Clinton was at the Secretary of State role. How many citizens did she make who are on the terrorist watch list? I hope that some of our Russian friends know, and they'll let us know within the next month or so.
Yes, exactly. Maybe Julian Assange can help us.
Exactly.
Find out.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You know, I do wonder about the what the plan was. You know, with San Bernardino, this is my personal opinion based on what I saw. You know, from what's been reported. You know, they had the shooting at the Christmas party, and after the shooting, he put his computer and cell phones in the microwave and started destroying his stuff. And they didn't even try to drive away until, you know, a few hours later. And that's when they were, you know, stopped and shot down in the streets. And, you know, this guy was found sleeping in the doorway of a bar in New Jersey not far at all from, you know, where his family owned a fried chicken restaurant, and not far at all from where he placed those pipe bombs. And so, you know, I really have to wonder if he was with the San Bernardino case, what I think happened is that this guy got triggered at the Christmas party, and he was putting together a very well thought out plan for a very developed attack. He was considering the school, we know from the pictures on his iPhone. But there was another guy, one of the victims of that shooting, was in one of these Christian Zionist sects where they don't celebrate Easter anymore, or Christmas, I think. And they celebrate Rosh Hashanah, and they celebrate Yom Kippur and all these things, and they're hardcore Zionists. And I'm got to imagine that these guys were getting into it again, which they often did at work, it sounds like. And this guy, Syed Farouk, was just triggered. And he went home and told his wife, all right, this is the day, you know, we're not waiting any longer. And that's why there was kind of a scramble in the afternoon to cover their tracks and then to belatedly escape. You know, there was – not everyone dies in the process of attacking, like Omar Mateen or the people who have bombs strapped to them. With the case of the Kawachi brothers and Ahmed Koulibaly, they're the ones who killed the folks at Charlie Hebdo mm-hmm. and the Kosher Market, respectively. They had a plan of several days of psychological terror. There was first the Charlie Hebdo attack, and then the guys remained at large, and they were hidden outside of the city. Then there was the Kosher Market attack, and it was staggered to be, days later after that happened. And all, you know, both the case of the brothers and of Koulibaly, they called into the same television station at roughly the same time to give their message to the public. In fact, Koulibaly was, you know, between making sandwiches and shooting the guy trying to steal his gun, he was watching BFM TV, which is kind of like their CNBC. He was watching that, and basically he knew he was clearly interested, right? What he was doing was he knew that the Kawachi brothers would call that particular station. He was waiting for them to call so that he would give a follow-up call. Now, with this guy, you have to imagine that his plan was better than, okay, I'm going to take a nap in a bar and then I'm going to walk somewhere, you know? So, you know, I wonder if he was a member of a team who was left out in the cold, who didn't make it out. There was the members of his family were arrested on their way to JFK, actually, before he was found. His wife had flown out of the country before the attack, just a couple days before the attack. Whether she was fully aware of the attack or not, who knows, but he was setting off bombs in the backyard, so probably. You know, I doubt she was at yoga class when he was doing this, you know. I'm sure she's chained to the kitchen stove, this lady. So I really have to wonder. And also there's the fact that, you know, these bombs were very different. You know, you had the pipe bombs in Elizabeth, you had the pressure cooker bombs in New York, and then it was at the first report I heard was it was M80s in Seaside. And also in amongst the pressure cookers, you had two different kinds of chemical compositions. So that's kind of an unusual thing, right, for one guy to make such different kinds of devices and from different materials. However, he seems to be the only one who was purchasing all the stuff. So he actually bought ball bearings on eBay and stuff like this. But I really have to wonder if this goes deeper than just one guy. And since he's a citizen, he can't be threatened with going to Guantanamo and being considered an enemy combatant. He can't undergo enhanced interrogation. So while, you know, if there are other team members, they are making their way across some border to some other safe house. And he has in his mind, okay, I've got 48 hours to sweat it out, and then I can talk.
Yeah, that's interesting. So we'll be hearing more from him soon then, in other words.
Probably. Yeah.
The fact that only one bomb actually went off makes me think that we're not dealing with the most intelligent person.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, how much of this can be attributed to simply
stupidity? Yeah, that's a good question, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they did find the rest of the bombs pretty quickly after the first one went off. And so, you know, what was his plan in terms of, you know, the timings for when he would do these explosions? It's hard to say. You know, there were and the way that they would be triggered is by the cell phone. So he probably had something in his mind about how he was going to stagger these.
Mm-hmm.
And but yeah, it's hard to say. It could be stupidity. It could be he had some kind of bigger plan. Yeah, it's I think also that we'll discover in the coming days. But yeah, there's one of the classic technique to maximize casualties. And I think this was done once in an abortion clinic bombing in the United States, is that you place one in the building, or at least you have a bomb threat in the building, and then you have another one outside the building. So when it's being, when everyone's exiting, then that one set off. And so, yeah, did he have some kind of plan like this? Yep. It's hard to say. I only know two of the locations, one on 23rd Street and one on 28th, I believe. So, the rest I'm not aware of, but, yeah, I think we'll find out soon enough, probably. But yeah. Then, of course, the night before those terrorist attacks in New Jersey and New York, and this was which totally overshadowed this, there was a Black Lives Matter-inspired shooter in Philadelphia who tried to kill a couple police officers and failed because of their vests. But he did manage to kill a very young Ethiopian girl who was coming home from a date. And before he was killed by a police sniper after taking a hostage in an alley. And then, of course, now there's Charlotte.
Yeah. Oh, and there was, of course, the stabbing rampage in Minnesota, which was Black Lives Matter and Allahu Akbar all mixed into one.
That's right, yeah. The Grand Coalition.
The Somalian.
That's, yeah. Yeah, another refugee, in fact.
Another refugee. Oh, that's good to know.
And also a guy who, you know, all of his community members said he was just a nice, quiet guy and loved to read and was like, you know, no one expected it. So, yeah, I mean, there are people who are never on the radar. There's some people who are on it sometimes and off it. I mean, there's just no predicting this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a great lesson. Again, nice, quiet Muslims who like to read, they could go crazy.
Yeah.
They could go jihad. They could start stabbing people at the mall.
Yep.
It just leads you to the conclusion that we just can't risk having these people. There's really no upside to it.
Yeah.
Even the ethnic food argument didn't work if this Afghani family were running a fried chicken joint. I could see, you know, an Afghan restaurant maybe, but not a fried chicken joint. We can cook our own damn fried chicken, I'm sorry to say.
There are a lot of young unemployed black guys, like 25% of them are unemployed. I'm sure they make fried chicken if you could
teach. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, it's really interesting. And so let's talk about the Black Lives Matter thing, because again, before Mike put on that magical oven mitt, we were talking about how Black Lives Matter and Muslim terrorism are really the two things that we think are going to put Trump in the White House. And so the BLM people have come through as well. And I haven't even been following this really in Charlotte. So for those of us out there who haven't been following it, give us a little background and maybe we can think about some of the implications of this, some of the dividends.
So the case in Charlotte is, you know, like so often, it's a case that's about white racism after a black cop shoots a black thug.
This narrative, it's like a freight train, right? You cannot stop the black victimization narrative.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if it's a Hispanic who shoots a black guy, he's a white guy. If it's an Asian who's a black, he's a white guy.
Yeah.
They promote them, you know, just to keep that narrative rolling on down the track.
You got it, yeah. And so, I mean, there have been a couple of cases where, you know, I think there was this one where it was like a policewoman in Tulsa shot a guy and, you know, she seems to have basically lost her cool and the guy wasn't a threat. They're going to have a first degree murder trial to figure that out. I just, you know, read on Drudge, there are some guys who forced someone when they arrested to eat a whole lot of marijuana. I think they're being fired. So, I mean, yeah, there's bad behavior, and for the most part, it's dealt with, and they figure it out. But, yeah, the inability of the black community to take responsibility for their social pathologies and for their sorry state, which doesn't seem to affect, you know, penniless Chinese who come to the United States, you know, we have to deal with this every now and again. And now it's Charlotte. It's on the brink of civil war, essentially. They had, I think by the thousands, people were looting for two nights in a row. There was a homeless white guy who was, I think he's in a hospital now, somewhere between life and death, he'd been kicked by dozens of black for the crime of being a white guy. I'm not sure how much that white privilege worked out for him as a homeless guy in Charlotte. And also, one of the protesters was shot in the head by another protester. So I guess, you know, people are settling scores if they run across the wrong guy. I guess people from, you know, different projects, when they come together to protest in the same spot, they can, that gives them an opportunity they don't really have, because I think most of them don't venture 10 blocks beyond the project their mother popped them out in. But yeah, tonight again, this is the third night, the National Guard has been sent out in the streets. And there is another protest, and the last I saw was that it's been declared an unlawful association, and they must disperse, or else they'll be forcefully dispersed. So we'll see what happens.
So what has the news reaction been to this? What kind of commentary has been coming up? What kind of excuses? The same old stuff?
I was listening to Cuckservative Radio in the car earlier today, and there was a lady who does their news coverage, who I guess is a little bit less, you know, to the right, in quotes, than the rest of the guys. And she was talking about how, you know, I saw that even in the 1970s, Charlotte was dealing with segregation in schools. So they've had problems that they've had to address very recently. You know, I think this is evidence of why the wise people of North Carolina didn't want to send their kids to desegregated schools, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, not a symptom of the fact that they were so wise and they were forced to desegregate by the federal government. But yeah, North Carolina is a state that went for Obama in 2008. I think it's a state where you have a lot of populist whites who are anti-war and anti-bankster. They elected a woman who had incredible national security pedigree and credibility, who was anti-war, who was a Democrat. She's since lost that seat. And it's an important one for Trump to win. And so I think that, you know, after these last couple days, he can basically check that box off and be certain that he's going to win that one. So hopefully it's close enough to Virginia so that the folks in the swing areas of Virginia will also vote for Trump. We'll see. It'll be tough because that's Tim Kaine's state.
Right. Well, he's such a formidable, charismatic figure.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, he won the Senate seat after Jim Webb vacated it, and he had also been governor before that. So he's won a few statewide races, and including, I mean, and that was the year that it seemed like Obamacare was still, helping a lot of Republicans win seats, and he managed to win. So, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. I mean, that's the thing is, like, from outside of a state, you know, it's hard to know when you have a local boy how deep his roots go and how deep his supports go. Actually, his whole political career really got a jump start by the fact that he's married to the daughter of a former governor as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, we'll see. Virginia. If Virginia's in play, then that looks very good for Trump. But he can win without Virginia.
The North Carolina polls show him pulling slightly ahead.
Yeah.
on average, the average is that he's a little more than 1 point ahead. Some polls have him at 5 points ahead and so forth.
Yeah.
So that's good news.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah. I think in the coming days we'll see it pull ahead and probably stick. Of course, you know, there'll be the impact of the debates, but yeah, here's the thing is that, you know, the debates would be a moment for Hillary Clinton to do what her husband once did, and that is to distance herself from the more radical elements of the left. And, you know, there is a lot that Bill Clinton did that was innovative in his 1992 campaign that's remembered. One of these is that they worked on every 24-hour media cycle, and they had a plan to dominate and to set the tone for every 24-hour cycle. And that was really spearheaded by, you know, James Carville. And that changed the way that presidential campaigns were done. The other thing was the sister soldier moment. And I don't know if we can we squeeze that audio in here, or should we just talk about it?
Let's just talk about it.
Yeah.
Give us basically the gist of it.
Yeah, so Sister Soldier made a lot of news. So that was a time also when there was a lot of racial tension. There was the Rodney King beating and the LA riots. I think this is before the OJ trial happened. Is that right?
I believe so.
I think
so,
it was before it.
Yes.
So yeah, but it was a time of heightened racial tension. And kind of, you know, continued on into the first couple years of the Clinton presidency. And during that, and, you know, also the crack epidemic was really hitting the inner cities pretty hard and the black community pretty hard. And Sister Soldier, who was a rapper, she said, basically, you know, why don't all the gangsters out there take 1 week off from killing other blacks and start killing whites? And then maybe they'll start paying attention to our problems. And Bill Clinton was giving a speech to the Rainbow Push Coalition, which was the, you know, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton. I think it was Jesse Jackson was still there, yeah, or Al Sharpton at least. And in it, he was talking about how he quoted Sister Soldier. Sister Soldier also said something like, "There's no, you know, all white people are devils. There's no such thing as a good white person." And then he looks up and he says, "There are such things as good white people. The white people were in this room right here with us now. You know, fighting for equality, right?" And and so he was able to and also she said specifically that that black people were not it was not possible for black people to be racist because they don't hold any power. So, you know, the Sister Soldier pioneered this part of this white privilege idea, right? That only whites can be racist and only, you know, heterosexuals can be racist, or only, you know, men can be racist. And that's the thing, is that at that time, Clinton did this, and he didn't need Sister Soldier and the people who were upset by that and who, you know, held her in such high esteem. And what he really needed was the center of the country. And with that, he didn't win a majority, but he won a plurality, and with it, the presidency. Now Hillary Clinton can't do the same thing in the current environment, can she?
No. She really needs blacks.
Yeah.
They're practically the only group that's very enthusiastic about her.
Yeah. Yeah, and also because at that time, the Sister Soldier narrative and the, you know, the white privilege narrative was really on the academic fringes. And now it's on the lips of almost every black person in the media.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So how should Trump play this? Trump is in a very different situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, Trump could have very well had a Sister Soldier moment as well after this alt-right speech. And I think that's what Hillary wanted to happen. You know, he could have come out and said, "Oh, I am, if I had been unclear as to where I stood about David Duke and racists like him, then I make it clear now," or something like this. And he never did. And instead, what he's doing is, and, you know, I've mentioned this insight into how campaigning works before. You know, I remember when Santorum was running in the primary, I guess it was 4 years ago, he made some comments against birth control. And he promoted the official position of the Catholic Church on birth control. And with that, he lost a lot of support all of a sudden. He lost a lot of conservative women, and he lost a lot of evangelicals. And, you know, what Joe Scarborough, who, you know, once was a congressman, said was that, you know, his credibility amongst the religious right was sky high. And so he could have stopped completely talking about any issue of social conservatism and just kind of, you know, wink and point at them and say, hey, guys, when I win, you win. And they would have been his foot soldiers still. They would have followed him all the way through and worked on his campaigns and showed up to vote for him while he reaches out to the center. And I think that, you know, Trump passed up definitely the opportunity to do a sister soldier moment. I don't think he will have a sister soldier moment regarding us. And I think he, and especially his son, will continue to, you know, wink and nod towards us. And in return, you know, we ought to be, even though we're not civic nationalists, we're not, you know, 100% on board with his views on Israel or any number of things, you know, we should work towards making him the president of the United States.
Yes, yes, indeed. So he's not going to signal against people to the right of him to go for the center. I think he probably has the center fairly locked up at this point. And I think that if he just repeats his calls for law and order and things like that, that is what's going to help him, you know, shore up any. In a way, he can do a sister soldier thing by attacking black radicals, right? If that's what you mean by a sister soldier moment, he can attack black radicals, and he's only going to win on that.
Yeah.
In fact, he doesn't have to say anything at this point, and he's still going to win on that.
Correct.
I mean, Hillary Clinton's her only response is to say, white people need to listen more to black people. It's like, no, I'm sorry, we're done listening. We got the message. We can't live with you people anymore. You got to put down the sneakers and put your hands against the wall.
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, she's really in a bind. And I think also she would lose a lot of her – basically she would lose the SJWs as well if she were to have a sister soldier moment and say anything against the white privilege narrative or to say anything against Black Lives Matter. I mean, she barely has them as it is. Because of the whole, and if she did have any separate, you know, moment where she criticizes Black Lives Matter or criticizes the rioters, you know, you could pull out all these videos of her talking about bringing super predators to heel, right? And mm-hmm. if you put these together and put it before a black audience, then, you know, they're going to start, even the ones who are more middle of the road than the Black Lives Matter crowd, mm-hmm. they're going to say, well, you know, has she been lying to us about not being a racist all these years? Like, is she really just like, this is what she thinks about us and our kids? And, you know, and they're just not going to show up, you know? I mean, even the ones who are not on board with, you know, DeRay McKeeson and all these, you know, just all this nonsense. And there are some of those out there. You know, basically the ones who call the cops when something goes wrong in their neighborhood, the ones who are sitting on their porches at night, you know, keeping track of who's doing what on their street. You know, they are the ones who are, you know, more of the center. But yeah, they are hyper, hyper sensitive to anything about race. I think the thing that I can tell you that in February, Trump had a lot more interest from the black community. And just by, you know, folks I know who were doing on the ground work in politics were seeing this all the time. I think the thing that hurt him the most, though, was actually the comments about the Mexican judge. Because
really,
yeah, because I mean, mm-hmm. even though they don't give it, I mean, they really don't give a shit about Mexicans, right? But just the mentality of being a minority, of being totally outnumbered, is such that as soon as anything. Their antennas on that kind of stuff is just super sensitive. And so right. as soon as they hear anything about that, then they're going to say, oh, wait a minute. Okay, maybe he does – maybe race is important to him, and he is going to put us on a different level when it comes time to fixing problems. You know, we're going to be his second thought. And so, yeah, I think that honestly, I think he had a lot more support than he did before. The Mexican comments hurt him big time, and he's slowly winning it back. And he's, you know, he's already at record numbers for a Republican. There was a poll out of Los Angeles where he had 15% of the black population of Los Angeles, which is just like mind blowing. That's even possible. And it would be interesting to see where they're coming from, because I don't think this is a question of social class either, because he's not, you know, hitting on economic issues that are appealing to the haves, right? He's appealing to the have-nots. And so I can't imagine it's the ones who've moved to the burbs and have adopted, you know, are white-presenting and have adopted, you know, economic self-interest of Republicans. I don't think that's what it is at all. I think it's just that he's got this unique autocratic character. He's the big man. He has a history of, you know, promoting the careers of Mike Tyson and Michael Jackson and all kinds of, you know, black celebrities since the 80s. And he has a rapport with them. And by addressing their number one issues, which are jobs and the economy, as it is with Latinos, their number one issues are jobs, the economy, and healthcare every time. And by addressing those issues in a more credible way than Hillary Clinton, he's starting to win over a small amount. And it's going to be an interesting – I think it's going to be really interesting how the coalitions are going to be shaken up this year. I think it'll be really interesting to see.
Well, Patrick, this has been a really interesting conversation. Let's wrap up here. Do you have any final thoughts on these themes? Maybe we can weave them all together.
I guess the ultimate thing is that – if we had a nice white country, we wouldn't have much to talk about, would we, in this podcast?
No, if white people had a country of our own, none of these things would have been happening.
We'd be able to, I don't know, listen to classical music and paint paintings and you know, send our kids off to play outside without having to watch them and worry. Yeah, I mean, life would be very different. We'd be spending our evening in a very different way than we are now. And we would have two candidates who would be, actually, let me put it this way. A good friend of mine, we've talked about this kind of thing often, that at the very least, we have to have a country where white people can safely disagree without being disempowered.
Right.
Because as it is now, any kind of disagreement between us can be exploited by smaller groups within the country, even though we're still a majority. And we have to get back at least to a place where we can have vigorous debate, vigorous disagreement, an adversarial political system with whites on both sides, where at no point we have to fear white disempowerment or displacement. And that used to be the case in Europe. That used to be the case in the United States. And the United States has not been the case for quite some time. And very soon it will be the case in Europe. So, yeah, the Overton window is shifting. Our issues are being listened to. White advocacy is seeing the light of day. It's thanks to the work of you and many others like you who have been toiling away, bringing these issues to the fore, you know, fostering a new dialogue, fostering new writers like myself, which I greatly appreciate, to get an alternative message out. And yeah, we're finally seeing that we're within reach of having an impact on policy. You know, and I hope that a lot of the listeners out there will take it to the next step. They'll volunteer on the campaign. They'll make phone calls. They'll find out if there are any locals who are calling themselves Trump Republicans, right? Who are offering this, you know, this post-conservative, nationalist, populist kind of rhetoric, and hopefully we'll follow through on it. Help them win. And if you're in a place where you can work outside the polls in the swing state, work outside the polls. If you can be a poll watcher, if you're in a place that's known for corruption, go be a poll watcher. That actually has a big impact on preventing bad behavior. And ask your boss now to have the weekend off before the election, to have the day of the election off, And even if you're in a state that's solid red or solid blue, go to the campaign headquarters and they'll have you call people in swing states to make the difference. So there's a lot of work to be done. Hillary has an incredible field operation. And even though she has to pay for every hour of work done on her campaign, you know, they're not volunteers lining up to help her out. There's no passion whatsoever for her. And she has to buy every vote, essentially. She might just have enough money to do that.
That's very concerning.
Yeah.
She just might have enough money to buy that.
Yeah, I mean,
buy the election.
Trump has promised to start bidding on pharmaceutical companies, right? Or, you know, when the government buys in bulk. You know, every country in the world, by the way, does that. The United States is the only one that does not. And that's because of the legalized system of bribery. The pharmaceutical companies have bought every elected official. If he were to put in place a bidding system, it would be tens of billions with a B, tens of billions of dollars a year lost to these corporations. Mm-hmm. So, spending, you know, a billion, taking it from what it was, you know, in the last contested elections, $1 billion for each party. So taking Hillary from $1 billion for her campaign to $2 billion is no problem for them, right? And God forbid they try to do something non-competitive, like assassinate Trump. That would be – but I guarantee you there are people who are sitting around thinking about that right now as they watch their future billions disappear. So just on that one alone, you know, that has nothing to do with race or the Jewish question or anything. It just has to do with being a populist, you know, like on that or just doing the right thing, being a decent administrator and doing the right thing. You know, both in the interest of the government and in the interest of the people that the government is supposed to represent. Just doing that one thing is enough to create a multi-billion dollar enemy. And so, and frankly, like to these pharmaceutical companies and for those who are making this money off of it, they don't care about any other thing that Hillary might do or about her capabilities in the job, even if she has to be, you know, rolled into the White House. So it's just follow the money with that. And of course, like you can repeat that for any number of other things that Trump has proposed, where there are a lot of oligarchs who are going to lose a lot of money because they've been on the gravy train. They've taken advantage of the American people and they own the American government. And they're watching for the first time what they thought was totally impossible, that a popular movement could take it away from them. So, everybody out there listening, you got to do something. You got to right now talk to your boss, say, I need that day off, I need that weekend off, and go out and work on that campaign and go wherever they send you and just work your ass off.
Wise words. Well, thank you very much. We will, I'm sure, continue this conversation soon.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Greg, for having me again, and great work at Countercurrents and at the New York Forum.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.